Welcome to the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. We've been doing it for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis, here in the studio of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, May 18th. And I'd like to ask you to please have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down names, addresses, telephone numbers, email, web pages, whatever it takes to take action for the environment. Let's get started with announcements. The Environmental Protection Information Center is announcing their EPIC Base Camp 2017. EPIC's network of volunteer ground truthers help monitor logging projects and other destructive activities in the Klamath National Forest and surrounding public lands. The information gained from ground truthing allows EPIC to provide the public with information needed to understand and engage in decisions affecting public forest lands, waters, wildlife, and communities. Information from on-the-ground monitoring also helps EPIC challenge bad logging projects, destructive grazing, and other Forest Service actions that degrade the environment at the expense of taxpayers. The base camp runs from June 9th to June 11th. Space is limited, so please RSVP for the event ahead of time. The location will be on the Klamath River near Happy Camp, and they will have carpooling available. There's a schedule on the website and what you need to bring. Once again, the EPIC Base Camp, June 9th through 11th, 2017. And for more information, go to wildcalifornia.org. And eco-prisoner Marius Mason is out of administrative segregation. And we get this story from the Earth First Newswire as presented by FightToxicPrisons.org. On May 8th, Marius Mason was moved out of the Carswell Federal Medical Center's administrative unit into the general population. While this is far cry from freedom, for the first time in nearly 7 years, Marius is able to see the sky and feel the grass beneath her feet. This welcome news comes weeks before the Fight Toxic Prisons Convergence to be held in the city of Denton, Texas, near FMC Carswell. The environmental activists and prison abolitionists organizing the conference have identified Carswell, located on a Fort Worth military base, as a prime example of toxic prisons worthy of national attention. Carswell has long been the subject of complaints about general conditions as well as being of special concern due to its administrative unit, which has housed political prisoners and individuals suffering from serious mental illness. Anti-nuclear activist Helen Woodson was held in the facility until her release in 2011, and other political prisoners, including Afia Siddiqui and Anna Belenmontes, remain there today. Since Mason's confinement in the administrative unit, advocacy efforts from his community, his lawyers, have been ongoing. Advocacy work has also included not only efforts to have him moved from the overly restrictive environment of the unit, but a successful campaign to secure gender-affirming hormone treatment, making him the first known prisoner authorized to begin female-to-male gender transition in federal custody. Also during his time in the administrative unit, the Bureau of Prisons has adjusted its policies on solitary confinement. Carswell's administrators gave no explanation for Marius's redesignation. Needless to say, friends and supporters believe the move is long overdue. And three conservation organizations have just stopped oil leasing on 1 million acres of public lands in California from the Earth First Newswire, originally written by Dan Zukowski of Enviro News. Environmental groups have reached a settlement with the Bureau of Land Management to stop plans for new oil leases on more than 1 million acres of public land in the state of California. The agreement announced on May 4th resolves a lawsuit by the Center for Biological Diversity and Los Padres Forest Watch, represented by Earth Justice. The suit came in response to a resource management plan approved by the BLM that would have allowed oil and gas drilling as well as fracking in Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo counties and along California's central coast. Also included in the proposed plan were vast stretches of agricultural central and San Joaquin valleys as well as the southern Sierra Nevada. This is a big victory for California and a major blow for Trump's plans to turn over our public lands to oil companies, said Brendan Cummings, the center's conservation director. Despite the petroleum industry's stranglehold on the White House, these beautiful wild places are still off limits to drilling and fracking. The BLM has not opened any oil leases in California since 2013, when a federal judge ruled that the agency had violated the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, by issuing oil leases in Monterey County without considering the environmental dangers of fracking. About half of all new wells drilled in California employ hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking, according to a 2015 report from the California Council on Science and Technology. That report also points out that fracking in California, due to its unique geology, is done in shallower wells than more concentrated chemicals than in other states. Volume 2 of the report warns that these chemicals can infiltrate groundwater aquifers, which farmers rely on for irrigation of crops, and that communities use for drinking water. This agreement ensures that the public lands along California's central coast and the communities that depend on them are protected from the harmful effects of oil drilling and fracking, said Los Padres Forest Watch Executive Director Jeff Kuiper. The center said the settlement continues the de facto leasing moratorium on BLM lands in place since 2013. And here's the update from the field, from the Buffalo Field Campaign. A week of contrast, wild calves frolic and play, while an injured mama is shot. Over the past month, Buffalo Field Campaign patrols are monitoring another injured adult female buffalo. Her hips were in bad shape, but the cause of the injury was not obvious. We weren't sure if she had been struck by a car or whether she had been born that way. Nevertheless, she migrated from deep within Yellowstone all the way to Horse Butte and was putting on weight and doing her best to keep up with the herds. We were keeping a close eye on her every day and hoping for the best. Unfortunately, residents in Yellowstone Village thought she was so badly off that they contacted our new Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks game warden. The game warden came out to observe her a couple of times for short periods and felt she wasn't going to make it. Even though Buffalo Field Campaign is out with these buffalo every day observing their behavior and migrations, he didn't contact us to discuss the situation. On Tuesday, he shot her. Her body was taken to the compost pile at the local dump. We contacted Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Region 3 director, who had no knowledge of the incident. He agreed that we needed to open the lines of communications with our new game warden. We called him, and to his credit, he felt that he was committing an act of compassion, that the buffalo wouldn't have made it. He was trying to do what he thought was best for her. He also said he has spent a lot of time in Gardner, has seen enough buffalo being shot, wounded, and left for dead. We certainly know how he feels. We talked about the need to be in communication with each other when such situations occur before such drastic actions were taken. We also talked about how much more beneficial it would have been to allow her body to be food for grizzly bears than to be thrown away like trash. He agreed and said he did contact a bear biologist but was unable to make contact. We always suggest relocating carcasses deeper into the forest so that grizzly bears can find them on their own away from humans and eat them in peace. When you take the time to listen to non-humans, they will tell you where they are. We made mistakes too, but we spent enough time with these buffalo, through good times and bad, that we understand them better than most. We experienced this back in December when a female buffalo was hit by a vehicle. She made it clear she was in pain, afraid, and dying, so we made it a difficult call to help her. Many of you will recall the other injured mama who died in Yellowstone Village a few weeks ago. She was much worse off than the buffalo killed this week, but she had the will to live and kept on trying. Although she didn't ultimately make it, she was at least given the dignity to die quietly on her own. The buffalo killed Tuesday was continuing to eat and move with the herd, albeit a little more slowly, and was not showing signs of giving up. We weren't about to give up on her either. We realize there are challenges when these things happen within a housing area, but we do live on the edge of Yellowstone, where grizzly bears or wolves could have had an opportunity to take her and feed their families. Talking with the game warden, it was clear that it was not easy for him to do this, and we wish he wouldn't have, but at least we have opened up communication and have agreed to work together to be helpful with our wild neighbors. On the bright side, Horse Butte is teeming with buffalo calves. Every day we are counting more and more calves. They are such a joy to watch, whether they are bedded down and napping in the flowers, frolicking with the others, trying out their new legs and learning how to spar with their wee button horns, or using hilarious maneuvers to convince their moms it's time to nurse again. We just can't get enough of it. And the best part is knowing that the government agencies cannot bother them here anymore. They simply get to be buffalo. They're moving around Horse Butte, mostly staying where people live, which is also an amazing thing to see. They enjoy being around people. They know the love that so many Yellowstone Village residents have for them, and they seem to be seeking that company out. They're hardly spending any time on the public land side of the butte, but instead prefer to be in the company of humans. There is no better living example of how easy it is to coexist with wild buffalo. People are even coming from other areas to drive into the village just to see the buffalo. More people are falling in love with them, and year-round habitat is proving to be beneficial to both buffalo and humans, and we trust this will help them gain more ground and more advocates as we press on in our work to protect these gentle giants and increase the areas where they can roam free. And you can find out more information about the Buffalo Field Campaign and what they do at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. They are looking for volunteers for this summer, so write them an email. You can find their address at buffalofieldcampaign.org. Up in Oregon, we have some news for you folks. The Oregon Wolf Plan has changes coming, and your action is needed. Cascadia Wildlands staff and dedicated volunteers recently returned from Klamath Falls, where we testified in front of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission in favor of strengthening Oregon's wolf plan as part of the mandated 5-year review process. Please take action today to tell the commission to bolster protection for Oregon's recovering wolf population. Given that the outcome of this process will guide Oregon wolf recovery for the next 5 years, the Commission granted our request that a hearing on the wolf plan's proposed changes be held in Portland on May 19th. On the evening of May 18th, we, along with our conservation colleagues, will be holding a public training in Portland on how most effectively to deliver testimony, and we will be planning a celebration for our dedicated volunteers after the Commission meeting tomorrow. Mark your calendars and stay tuned for times and locations. We are at a critical juncture of wolf recovery in Oregon, and your voice is needed. And you can find out more information at cascadiawild.org. That's cascwild.org. Also in Oregon, suction dredge mining reform is coming to a salmon stream near you. We are gaining significant traction with our efforts to reform the destructive practice of suction dredge mining in Cascadia. Miners vacuuming up stream beds in search of gold flecks are killing endangered fish, insects, and poisoning our water. In Oregon, legislation protecting key salmon waterways is from being mined to death recently passed out of the Senate and is now being considered in the Oregon House. For Oregon residents, please take action to help move that bill forward in the House. In Washington State, still the Wild West for suction dredge miners is proving to be a harder nut to crack. Last week, Cascadia staff traveled to Wenatchee to meet with stakeholders and visit some of the hardest hit areas, and our legal team is hot on their trail. After seeing the destruction firsthand, we are more than determined than ever, and the campaign to reform suction dredge mining in Washington is moving full speed ahead after having filed a notice of intent to sue the state of Washington in January. And once again, for more information, especially on how to take action, please go to cascwild.org. That's cascadiawild.org. And scientists saving Hawaii's rarest plants need to be saved themselves. In this story by Alessandra Potenza of the Verge.com. 4,000 feet above sea level in Hawaii's Koke State Park, the weather is drier and cooler than the island of Kauai below. Unlike the lowland, where invasive species dominate the landscape, there's a forest of mostly native trees and plants all around us. It's very pleasant to walk in, said Steve Perlman, a field biologist who's been at the forefront of protecting Hawaii's endangered plants for over 40 years. He's known for rappelling from ridges to find rare plants. In 2014, he joined the Plant Extinction Prevention Program, which focuses on protecting Hawaiian plants that have only fewer than 50 individuals left in the wild. We arrived at a spot where the trail enlarges a bit and is covered in gravel. The gravel was put there after the trail flooded and hikers began piercing another trail through the forest, unknowingly walking over rare and precious native plants. Proman points one out. It's small and frail with a beautiful elongated white flower and over 10 buds. It's called the Kopiko flower, and there are only 30 or so plants left on Kauai, the only Hawaiian island where it grows. Kopiko is in danger for a variety of reasons. It has to compete with voracious weeds that are not native to Hawaii, as well as deal with non-native pigs, goats, and deer that love munching on its leaves, and rats that eat its seeds. Most of the plants that are left are also female, Perlman says, so it's hard for them to get pollinated by the rare males. If they're not pollinated, they can't make seeds and reproduce themselves. This is where Perlman and Pep come in. With the help from a botanist from Japan, Perlman and his colleagues have been hand-pollinating the remainder Kopikas by collecting valuable pollen from male plants and dabbing it onto the female flowers, allowing them to reproduce. This plant with the beautiful white flower we're looking at along the trail is the natural offspring of that artificial pollination. And it's safe to say that if it weren't for Pep, this plant species would have been extinct in the wild by now. And Kopiko is just one example. There are currently 238 plant species that PEP is trying to save from extinction. But the future of the program itself is in peril. Since its beginning in the early 2000s, the program has been funded by mostly federal money. The budget varied from year to year, but it was about $1 million, said Joan Yoshikawa, Hawaii's statewide PEPP manager. The bulk of that money, about 70-90%, came from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, she says, as well as other federal grants. In the past year alone, the fish and wildlife funding has been cut by 50% to about $500,000, and come October, when the new fiscal year begins, Yoshioka is expecting more cuts, possibly another 50%. Including all sources of revenue, PEP raised only 75% of its budget this year, Yoshioka said. Perlman's helicopter budget, around $50,000, has already been slashed, he said. He desperately needs that money to access rare species that only grow on steep cliffs where no cars can get to. Without the federal money, saving endangered species will be a real challenge. It may mean we lose species, Yoshioka said. That's just the reality of it. The cuts aren't only coming from Fish and Wildlife Service, either. PEP has seen its budget from the state of Hawaii decrease as well, and private grants are getting harder to get. We've received cuts all across the board, she said. And a popular sport fish may be headed for broad extinction in California in this story from Scientific American, written by Ann Mulkern. 45% of California's native salmon, steelhead, and trout species face extinction within 50 years, and nearly three-quarters will be wiped out within a century without intervention, a study released recently says. The analysis from Caltrout and the University of California Davis Center for the Watershed Sciences blame climate change as a primary culprit, titling the report "The State of Salmonids 2, Fish in Hot Water." It details the status of 32 types of salmon, steelhead, and native trout in the Golden State. Climate change is and will have wide-ranging effects on California salmonids across the state, said Patrick Samuel, Conservation Program Director for Caltrout, a fish and watershed advocacy group. Climate change is reducing the amount of cold water available to our fishes, which is critical to their survival. Climate change alters the volume and timing of stream flows, which degrade habitats and alter food resources for the species. Salmon, steelhead, and trout all depend on cold water for survival, the report said. Climate change is over the arcing threat to our cold water, Samuel said. California's historic drought, which Governor Jerry Brown recently declared over, may hurt fish, the report authors said. The drought here is not over for these fish due to a time lag in the species' life cycle, said Rob Lusardi, one of the UC Davis authors. The findings are important not just for those who love to fish or going fishing, said Curtis Knight, Caltrout executive director. It's not an answer to simply farm fish if freshwater varieties die off. Freshwater fish are the kind of a canary in the coal mine for water quality. Their health and their resilience indicates healthy waters, which is important for all California's drinking water, agriculture, and commerce, and the health of people and the environment in which we live, he said during a call with reporters. The decline of the fish indicates the decline of all our water. That's important to all Californians. The report will be used to help urge lawmakers and others to make changes that can help fish. This report should rightly be considered an alarm bell, but it should also be seen as a roadmap for how we can correct course to better support native aquatic species, said study co-author Peter Moyle. Thanks to ongoing scientific research, we now know what to do and where to improve the plight of native fish. One in particular could counteract a climate impact is restoring meadows, Knight said. More precipitation is expected to come as rain rather than snow in the future. That means the snow in the state Sierra Nevada will fall farther north in the state, and the snowpack traditionally has provided water as it melts in the spring and summer. Meadows, they can act as these reservoirs to slowly release water, and a lot of them are degrading, particularly at the 5,000 to 8,000 foot level, Knight said. In the face of climate change, it's going to be important to restore them so that they can capture rain runoff to store and then slowly release it. The report was an update of one done in 2008. The revision is needed because, in part, the impacts of climate change have become more clear, said Moyle, associate director for the Center for Watershed Sciences. We have a lot more information than we did 10 years ago. And the Sportsman Alliance for Alaska writes that the Pebble Mine is back and Bristol Bay is at risk. As an unintended consequence of last year's election, the developers of the proposed Pebble Mine in Bristol Bay got what they've been praying for since 2014 when they resorted to delaying tactics and litigation to prevent the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, from finishing its work that would protect the greatest wild salmon fishery on Earth. After all, I can't imagine too many people went into the voting booth thinking, I'm voting for him because he'll build the Pebble Mine at the top of their list. But unintended or not, the consequences are very real. In a move that doesn't really scream America first, the new leadership at the Environmental Protection Agency has sided and settled with a small-time Canadian mine promoter over science, facts, Alaska natives, commercial fishing interests, anglers and hunters, and the overwhelming majorities of the Bristol Bay residents and Alaskans statewide, and millions of Americans who participated in the public process that led to the Environmental Protection Agency's common-sense proposed restrictions on the disposal of mine waste in two of Bristol Bay's most productive watersheds. And here's a summary of the important takeaways from the settlement agreement. Taken away, the EPA will begin a process within 60 days to consider withdrawing the 2014 Clean Water Act proposed restrictions on disposal of mine waste in Bristol Bay. There will be opportunity for public participation. Be ready to take action. Pebble must begin the permit application within 30 months. If it does so, EPA agrees not to use Section 404C of the Clean Water Act until 48 months from the date of the settlement or until a final environmental impact statement is issued, whichever comes first. Basically, EPA is tying its own hands and limiting when it can use the Clean Water Act to address these concerns in Bristol Bay. EPA may use the findings of the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment without limitation. This is an important point because the BBWA underpinned EPA's decision to invoke Section 404C of the Clean Water Act and place the proposed restrictions on disposal of mine waste in Bristol Bay. The BBWA may be used during the course of permit processing and the EPA oversight of those applications. Loss of the BBWA would have made a bad deal even worse. And tree clearing may have killed 180 koalas in Queensland in 2 years, says a wildlife group. World Wildlife Fund, writer Joshua Robertson contributed this story. Tree clearing may have killed as many as 180 koalas in southeast Queensland in the last 2 years after the former state government relaxed vegetation protection laws, according to an analyst in the World Wildlife Fund. The environmental group says a crisis crippling koala populations has its root in a surge in tree clearing, given the political green light in both Queensland and New South Wales, Australia. Koala deaths in southeast Queensland, compounding a trend that has wiped out half of the koala population statewide in the last 2 decades, came from the bulldozing of 44 square kilometers of bushland between mid-2013 and 2015, World Wildlife scientist Martin Taylor argues. The wave of deaths pushed the iconic animal further towards extinction in former strongholds, primarily in Brisbane's north. They were followed by an ongoing surge in fatal koala injuries from vehicles and dog attacks that the Royal Society for the Protection of Cruelty to Animals fearing for their long-term survival in the region. In New South Wales, there are also fears of local koala populations being wiped out after total numbers fell by an estimated 26% in the past 2 decades, according to a separate World Wildlife Fund reported by the University of Queensland academic Christine Adams Huskings. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio in Santa Cruz, California. In North Adams, Massachusetts, you can listen to WMNB 107.1 on Fridays, 5:30 p.m. KRFP 90.3 in Moscow, Idaho, broadcasts the Earth First Update Wednesdays at 3 p.m. KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, airs the Earth First Update Saturday at 7 a.m. and WLSL in Dade City, Florida at 92.7 FM, broadcasts at Sunday at noon. KHCF, KGIG, KPHD, and Berkeley Liberation Radio also broadcast the Earth First Update at various times. And you can always listen to radio4all.net. That's radio, the number, 4all.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous editions of the Earth First Update. And I'm asking you to please contact your local nonprofit community radio station and ask them to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio. It's produced at Free Radio Santa Cruz. And I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.